Calling all education entrepreneurs, EdSpace is Europe's unique education innovation hub, including a shared workspace in London and a global network for everyone who wants to transform education. Pick from a range of membership packages to suit you, or attend one of our classes, workshops or meetups. To register, visit www.edspace.io, and for an exclusive podcast one-third off your first month when you sign up as a member, use the promo code PODCAST.
Hello and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. I hope you've all had marvellous weeks, and for those UK schools which have just left for the summer holidays, have an amazing break. In this week, where UK chip company Arm sold to Japanese firm SoftBank for £24.3 billion, we are looking at investment, and I'm in conversation with EdTech angel investor Deborah Quazzo of GSV ASU fame. I'm also doing all I can to not fall into the trap of talking about Pokemon Go, as it's such an obvious story. But my husband does inform me that at the University of London, literally hundreds of people are filling Bloomsbury Square to play the game. My only comment on it will be, educators, you'd be crazy not to make the most of this phenomenon, wouldn't you? Let me know how you're putting the game to use, whether it's geography, orienteering, triangulating, computer science or anything else, I'd love to know. Which then brings me on to the mention of ex-Angry Birds team from Rovio setting up Lightnear and featuring this week's podcast. Lightnear are developing a game which teaches kids about physics and science through periodic table game playing. With heavyweights on board, including ex-Angry Birds and advisors from CERN and Harvard, it's something that certainly jumped out for me during this interview. Also included, challenging the factory model of education with a modernised version of Montessori and personalised learning. Shout outs to some of Deborah Quazzo's 47 angel investments from pre-K to grey, and why EdTech, which is positive and not punitive, wins out the day with educators. This was a great discussion with Deborah Quazzo, who was in town for EdTech Europe back in June and pre-Brexit. If you're an entrepreneur listening and think you can make a difference in closing education inequality, one of the key topics of this podcast, please check out the message from the Young Academy during the middle of the podcast. I met with James Teasdale this week, and they are looking for new applicants for their incubator programme who see the benefit in innovating education. That's all for now. Check out all the extras on Twitter, and I hope you enjoy. Get started. So I'm here in a very sophisticated property in Mayfair, which is quite ironic because when I first looked up the address, there's a similar address in East London near West Ham, but we're definitely in West London. And I'm here with what I've decided is the First Lady of Investment in EdTech, Deborah Quazzo, who is the founder and partner from GSV. So Deborah, absolutely fantastic to conduct this interview with you, so thank you. You're very busy during your time in London. Just to kick off, would you be able to give the listeners a kind of overview of who you are?
Sure.
You know, what's your involvement in EdTech?
Sure. You know, I was an investment banker for over 30 years. I'm embarrassed to say how many years at this point. About 20 years ago, I partnered with a guy named Michael Moe, who's still my partner. We've been partners for 20 years, remarkably. He's based in Silicon Valley, and he had been really a Wall Street growth stock research analyst, looked at themes in the growth economy and tried to identify the next emerging investment themes. Education was a core theme that he developed early in the mid-1990s, actually, before anybody was talking about an ed tech sector or the idea that there would be a lot of innovation happening. And it was really all around what could happen in innovation. His thesis was that, you know, like healthcare, huge portion of GDP, massively dysfunctional, little application of technology, highly fragmented, et cetera, and that you should see, you know, a flood of entrepreneurs come into the sector to try to fix really very important problems that are going to not only, as he likes to say, impact how an individual does, how a state does, how a country does, how a world does, really. So, you know, with much bigger implications. So, that is, Michael and I partnered 20 years ago. We started a company actually, together called Think Equity Partners, sold that to a UK firm, and then began what became GSV, generally Global Silicon Valley, which has different arms and legs to it. In our past, we had really focused on broad growth, you know, software, semiconductors, biotechnology, I mean, really the whole swath of growth pieces. But I had become really passionate around the education topic, both from an education innovation topic, from a philanthropic, civic, and professional perspective, and just saw the power and the potential of addressing some of these massive issues we have in achievement gaps between low-income and middle- and high-income individuals, and certainly in the U.S. and globally. And because if we can't cure those things, you know, people are not going to have access to the future, and that's a big problem for all of us. So I had become quite passionate about that, decided in 2000, we started this business in 2008, that I was going to really hunker down and focus really solely on what we call learning and talent innovation. And at that point began to make angel investments. So we were doing advisory activities. So we were working with companies on their strategic plans and whether they wanted to raise capital or sell their businesses or whatever. But I also at the same time began to make an angel investment. So today I have about 47 angel investments across what we like to call pre-K to gray. So really from early childhood all the way up through you know, lifelong adult learning. And then we also around 2009-10 really partnered with Arizona State University, which is the largest public university in the U.S. In 2010, it was not apparent to people how innovative they were. That's, you know, the cat's out of the bag on that now. But at the time, people didn't understand the partnership, and it's been a fantastic partnership. And with them, we have produced an annual event called the ASU GSV Summit, which has grown from over its 7 years completed, but history has grown from 240 attendees to 3,750 this year. And it is all about celebrating innovation in learning and talent, really across the spectrum from technology companies to large technology players, to importantly leading educators, to at the K-12 level, at the higher ed level, at the adult learning level. So we really try to bring together a very, very broad set of constituents, because we think that's the only way problems get solved is to do that. So.
And so I know this year at GSVSU, you had Condoleezza Rice and Bill mm-hmm. Gates and Sal Khan speaking. Do you have any sort of behind the scenes stories from that event? You know, I know the delirium can kick in at some of these events. Are there any funny stories from this year or memorable occasions?
Oh, you know, for those folks, I mean, I think we were very blessed. We had a great lineup, people who are all obviously passionate about making a difference. You know, I think the talks went off, were extremely well received across the board. I mean, and the comment I've kind of consistently made to people, and we had Jim Collins, who's a, you know, very famous, really globally, you know, strategic leader who's been spending his last 2 years researching the issues around educational leadership. So we had a lot of people with, you know, great followings and great prominence. And it's not a funny story, but I said the most delightful part about it was they were all humble, and their teams were humble, and they were such a delight, and, you know, and absolutely no egos involved whatsoever. And they were such a delight to work with. So if we can replicate that again, I'll be a very happy woman. But
excellent. And yeah. So I mean, from your point of view, you you know, I can't imagine, you know, how busy you are given your role, and you're here in London. I read also that you know, exercise and family are important to you, as well as edtech investing. And so, you know, for people, you know, in the investment side of things, or also educators that are trying to fit everything in, do you have any personal tips on the ultimate work-life balance conundrum?
Well, you know, that is a conundrum. Well, you know, I did go to cycle twice this morning, so I did I did two classes this morning. So, yes, I do. I don't normally do that, but I do think it's interesting. I think one of the trends that's coming really into the world, but I think is also impacting the education space, is, you know, just the focus on mindfulness. And we had Carol Dweck at the summit this year, who's a Stanford psychologist who really began the growth mindset work. And I think that intertwines with mindfulness, and just the, you know, the fact that you know, we all have the potential to continue to grow our minds. There's not a fixed IQ that you were born with, which I was told when somebody in first grade by my headmaster, I remember distinctly. And that wasn't at all true. And so I do think, and we're seeing, you know, meditation, and we're seeing, you know, the companies like Calm and Headspace, which are doing, Calm's founded by two UK entrepreneurs who've now moved to San Francisco, incredible millions of followers on, you know, guided meditation. So I haven't actually, I mean, I'm not, you know, I have not, I'm not an active meditator, but I do find exercise, and I find reading, and I find, so I do things like that, is that you got to have those as part of your day, or you're not going to be able to keep your head. You know, you really do need headspace. I actually love the term headspace, because you really do need your headspace. So I think that's been a good trick for me.
That's very topical in the UK at the moment as well. There's a big discussion around mental well-being of students, and you know, whether there is a crisis or not. So the DfE and perhaps some high-profile bloggers or thought leaders in this space disagreeing on that. But yes, certainly.
That's interesting. We see. I mean, I'm from Chicago, and I was on the Chicago Public School Board for 2 years, and we, you know, very proudly, one of the best experiences I've ever had in my life. If you wanted to, you know, develop the right empathy, it was the only ability to do that is to stand in people's, individual shoes. But yeah, I mean, the violence that we've been, you know, for if you guys have been following it, the highest murder rates in the country in terms of gun violence, and particularly really isolated in low income communities. So the kind of trauma that our school kids and our school system is, you know, 398,000 kids, 87% of whom are low, free and reduced lunch, which means low income, which is really remarkable. And so these kids are, yeah, I mean, I think it's extremely, an extremely important topic, because I think it's, you know, I think things like meditation and mindfulness and other things are going to be really important as we try to help kids who are trying to learn in the context of pretty, you know, deep trauma, you know, whether it's gun violence, which is unimaginable, or issues at home or whatever. And I think it is a really important issue in education, actually. I think the rest of us are all coming into it because we're all overstimulated by all the devices that we're all on all the time.
Well, I noticed you're on Twitter, but you don't tweet.
No, I don't. I'm not. I follow.
That's probably good for your mindfulness.
Yeah, I follow. I can't. I have not mastered. Everybody's really impressed that I've gotten active on Facebook and Instagram. That's like that. Apparently, that's a big move forward
for
me.
Yeah, I think I've seen your Instagram. So as well as Chicago, I also saw that you advise Harvard Business School and Teach for America, or have done. So, you know, from taking part in those organizations, are there any challenges that you see as a commonality across educators and students that keeps resonating in terms of top challenges? Or I suppose, to boil that down, what are the problems in education that need solving that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the reasons I got, you know, so, and let's be clear, technology is not the silver bullet. It's not going to solve everything. And we need great teachers that, you know, and we need to give in the K-12 segment. We can start with K-12. Higher ed's got as many issues as K-12. And then adult learning has actually got even more issues, because we've got, you know, in the United States, we have a population that's roughly 30-35% have college degrees, and 80% of our jobs are going to need them. So we have this massive gap in of low-skilled, with low-skilled adults who are going to need to be, educated in the adult side. But on the K, and obviously that starts at K-12. If we were doing a better job in K-12, we would have less of an issue with low-skilled adults in the U.S. But yeah, I think in one of the reasons I have got excited early. I mean, a number of reasons actually got excited early on about the possibilities for technology and being in. I spent a lot of time in schools. I spent a lot of time watching teachers. Watching classrooms and how the interactions, talking to teachers about what they're using, either whether it's a technology or a new technique or a new classroom layout or whatever. And I think that, clearly one of the problems, particularly in a district like Chicago with a, with 87% low income students, is that there is, we have a factory model, and yet all the kids are in different places. So we have this, broadcast model with one person at the front, and they're teaching the same way to every child, and every child is really at a different place. And it is very dramatic. We see, I'm on the board of KIPP charter schools, and we can see kids coming to kindergarten at, 4 years, in one room, children who are 4 years levels of ability apart, even at that early age, which is just, amazing. So I do think one of the things that we're seeing that's exciting around technology is not only we're seeing some technology that can personalize learning, so adapt to the to each individual child while giving the teacher leverage to teach the entire class. And I think we're also seeing technologies that allow teachers to create real differentiation, break up the broadcast model. I think the most exciting thing, I just did a couple tours of schools in the last month, and I interestingly think we are kind of, it's everything, new is old again, or old is new again, or whatever the phrase is. The schools where we're really seeing, I think a lot of the schools we're seeing in the U.S., great progress, are really Montessori's in a modern model. So if you go back to the old Montessori, which, didn't have, it was a free-flowing structure where it was competency-based and project-based learning, no technology for sure. But if you look at their Summit Schools, is a very famous high school system in California that has, hit, just is the top of the, is the top performing high school system in the state. And if you go in their classrooms, what you're seeing is, they're all in groups. They're not desks, they're pods, and they're using technology very effectively to kind of support this much more decentralized method of teaching. And so I think that's not, it's really interesting. I mean, it's you're beginning to see. I mean, I just was reading a book about Google by Google's head of people, Laszlo, I'm getting the last name wrong, Bernie, but and he reminded me, which I guess I kind of knew, but Google manages Google like a Montessori, actually, if you read the book. And of course, Larry and Sergey, whom I don't know, but they were both Montessori children, which was kind of interesting, yeah. Right? So I think that they're...
So potentially it started way back in the beginning in their...
I think it is interesting. And what we're seeing in Chicago in these two schools that I just went to visit, where they've really broken down, they're just no more sitting at a desk in a row. Enough of that. You're going to meet on a couch, and you're going to move at your own pace. And what we've seen, because the two schools that I just visited are in very low-income areas where there's a lot of trauma, is that the kids are being, so what's happening is kids are being given responsibility, right? So you go in the classroom, and it's complete order. I mean, it's kind of ordered chaos in a wonderful way, right? So, and what they've seen in just a year of implementation in both these schools is that disciplinary issues have dropped precipitously, because suddenly you aren't telling, Joey, he's got to sit at this desk in a row and watch that teacher, which he has no desire to do. You're actually allowing some children to have their own, some role in their own academic direction. And, what a shock. They respond well to it.
And so going back to the skills gap, and obviously that's a problem here in the UK and in many countries, do you think that, this directly correlates, or there's some connection to what we can see, potential issues around sort of Trump and Brexit and the context that we live in at the moment. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure I could possibly bite off that one. I don't know. I'm actually trying to ignore that part and hope that we have enough sensible people that, I will not be supporting Donald Trump, that is for sure, and I mean, his position on things like our Common Core movement, he's totally against the Common Core, which is an elevation of standards for American children. I don't know, the alternative is we keep standards low. So some of the positions are just so nonsensical.
But I suppose from an investment point of view, especially things like Brexit are just they're kind of an irritant for you.
Well, for us, I don't think that's really, I don't think, we have a few investments. We have two investments in the UK, one in Helsinki, looking at a couple other. Actually, we think the UK is a very interesting place to be. To be looking, it's not got the volume of activity for sure as the U.S. I mean, if you come to the summit, you'll see it's just we could have 2,000 companies present there if we had the capacity, which we don't. But we're very intrigued with some great things happening in the EU. I don't think Brexit's gonna, because most of the companies to be scaled and successful out of the EU, you're going to need to be global. So you're going to need to be either it's a consumer company with a freemium model that's, Kahoot is a company in Oslo that has, I'll get the number wrong, but tens of millions of users. It was a freemium model, huge position in the U.S. And in fact, the U.S. is their dominant market position with teachers. It's a great platform in the classroom. So I think the Brexit pieces, I think you said it right. I think it's an irritant, but I don't think it's anything unless there are pieces related to the to venture capital and startups that would come out of Brexit that I'm not aware of. But
okay, and then
in the American presidential election, I can't even.
It's just interesting times that we're going through at the moment.
I think that. Actually, I think it's emblematic of the problem we've got in the United States. We've got a lot of people who feel like they're not participating in our democracy. And so we've had this, we have violently extreme reactions on left and right, violently. We have extreme reactions, which seems like a fair reaction. I mean, because you have Bernie Sanders on way left and Donald Trump on way right, and very little strength in the middle. All the other Republicans were in the middle. Hillary is somewhere between the middle and left. But I actually think it's completely emblematic of what the issues we've got in delivering quality education to all of our citizens right now, because people feel like they don't have access to the future, and I think that's very much ties back to the issues of education.
Calling all education entrepreneurs. The Young Academy is an incubator and investment program for innovative ideas in the education sector. We offer a series of specialized workshops, expert support, and the opportunity to apply for up to £150,000 of investment from our fund to help you grow. Our next program will launch in the southeast of England this autumn, and applications are now open. To find out more and apply, visit www.theyoungacademy.org. That's www.theyoungacademy.org.
And so I suppose that, it can be anywhere from, during the school life, but also we talked about higher education and lifelong learning. And one thing I looked up was there was a total of $1.85 billion raised across 198 deals.
It was about $2 billion in 2015.
And the greatest majority of that was towards higher education.
I'm not sure that's right, actually. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think it was still skewed to K-12. Certainly in number of transactions.
The question was going to be around that. Was certainly here, when I've spoken to people, lots of companies are focusing on K-12 mm-hmm. because higher education in terms of the institutions and the culture tends to be more cautious. It's more, it's slower to get uptake. But I suppose there's interest in that area because in terms of the scale of what you can do is quite interesting.
Well, I think it's the opposite. In the United States, there has been the K-12 sector, I'd say people are very cautious on right now, and I think it's historically had it has been historically an area that top venture capitalists have stayed away from because procurement issues and political issues and the difficult sales cycle, et cetera, have been a death knell. The very dominant positions of legacy providers like UK-based Pearson and McGraw-Hill and others just made it an absolute nightmare for startup companies to have adequate capital, even if they had a great product, to get it sold into systems. And so that I think it continues to put a bit of a pall on that market. There are some companies in K-12, and I've been fortunate enough to invest in a couple of them, that have seen really quite remarkable scaling. But they've found new models, either riding the company called Clever, which basically sits on digital content providers and provides them a data integration with schools, and so they don't have to develop the same kind of sales force that others have had to do that are so costly. A company called Class Dojo, which has a huge global position, very large position here in the UK, which is a free offering in schools that they will begin to work on monetization strategies this year. But it's a really cool platform where teachers, every child has a what do they call them? The little character. For some reason, I've got a mental
avatar.
Block. Avatar, thank you. I've got a mental block on the word avatar. Wish they'd change the word. But every child has it, and it sits on the board during class, and the teacher sends positive messages to children. And the radical idea there was that, K-12 school having a bit of a punitive bias to it, the idea of actually having a completely positive bias to it, just made teachers really embrace this offering. So I think we've seen a few breakthroughs on the scaling front in K-12 in the U.S. and globally. Kahoot's another good example, but those are still few and far between. I think investors are sort of sitting back and waiting to see if any of these models can actually turn into revenue producing and profit producing companies that make them sustainable. So I think it is a little cautious. In the higher ed side, I think we had tended to see lots of seed investing in K-12 and not so much in higher ed, but what we saw in higher ed had a lot of good follow-on. So I think the depending on where you put the MOOCs and things like that, they are obviously, in our view, or higher ed and adult learning or lifelong learning and enterprise learning. But there's been some, in the U.S., I think we've seen some, very good investments made into companies that have incredible traction in their business models in the higher ed and then sort of lifelong and adult and workforce, learning where they can apply it all the way across. So I don't know why it would be reverse. And maybe it's just the sheer number of universities we have at, 4,500 or whatever. That kind of creates, the opportunity perhaps for more disruptive activity. Arizona State's actually a great example. When we started the ASU GSV Summit with them 8 years ago, they had, I think, 4 technology partners. Today they have over 140, and one of the reasons they wanted to do this event with us was that they wanted to, get themselves in the center of what was happening from an innovation perspective, because, they're all about increasing access, and President Crow there is, a very strong believer in the idea that, we rank our universities by how few people they take, is ludicrous, and his objective is to take as many as he can and to have all of them come out of that experience is highly, successful and competent and able to go into the work world. So I think we have some universities like that taking big risks. I mean, and then we have others where it makes it interesting for companies and entrepreneurs to begin to try to make things. I mean, Stanford's another great example. Tons of entrepreneurial activity has come out of there, generally. I mean, for the whole, for every industry in the world, but in particular, I think in education, we see a disproportionate amount of entrepreneurs out of the Stanford programs as well. And MIT, same incredibly out there, Carnegie Mellon, so I don't know if that's what the reason is, but our higher ed, post-secondary, sort of innovation ecosystem does feel, you know, it has felt like a pretty healthy one.
Yes. And how about your time here in London? Would you say, you know, have there any startups caught your eye or any conversations?
Yeah, no, and I come here at least twice a year, and probably more like three or four or five times. It's a pretty easy hop at the end of the day. We've had some good conversations. As I said, we are an investor in Gojimo, and we're an investor in Bridgeu. There are a couple of other folks that we've talked to that we're, you know, extremely interested in, and we have a position in Lightnear, which is Helsinki based. They were here in town last week, and which is a gaming platform team that spun out of Rovio, and I think doing very, you know, really interesting stuff.
What were they called again?
It's called Lightnear, and they're building very, you know, sophisticated and beautiful games based on physics and chemistry, and it's really quite special. If they can pull it off and really get the kind of adoption that the Angry Birds folks did, and really at the same time teach children physics, principles of physics and chemistry, without their really even knowing they're doing it, it's a very compelling proposition, I think.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few sort of math-based games and that kind of thing, but yeah, moving into science and physics, that, I mean, obviously there's a huge need for that as well in terms of science having that focus.
Well, it's just core learning, right? And it's what they can do. I went to Helsinki last week and saw some of the characters in their full animated state, and it's
they should have made you a character.
I am on their website. I do have an avatar. Which I didn't realize until my daughter pointed it out to me. But it's because it's such a core learning, and you can actually, if you think about it, the characters are based on the periodic table. So if you can, you know, use your imagination, you can imagine how many stories, because it's all about storytelling, right? And it's not just a game; it's a long tail storytelling, and you can imagine how many stories happen
the Mr. Men of the periodic table, it sounds like.
When you combine things on the periodic, you can create all kinds of adventures when you're combining things on the periodic table. So yeah, it's exciting. I think what they're doing is exciting.
Okay, so after this meeting and interview, I'm off to present at an event called Women Ed, which is a collection of female education leaders in the UK primarily. And, you know, obviously there's a bit of an issue there in terms of when people get into the leadership teams, although the teaching profession is dominated majority female, it drops off in the leadership side of things. In terms of the parallel in ed tech and technology and investing, that's probably fairly similar. And you are leading the way. Terms of that, do you have any messages to those education leaders when I get there?
It's fascinating. So we actually started, I think on two sides. One, we totally have the parallel issue on the teacher side. And in fact, I'm speaking at an event that some terrific women have pulled together at the end of July for the first time to gather leadership on the teacher and in the educator, K-12 educator side, because we have exactly the same issue where the professional cores are dominated by women, and yet when you get up to superintendent and principals and things like that, the numbers do not, you know, they don't hold. And that is mystifying, actually. I was stunned by how bad the numbers were, actually, when they pointed them out to me. We've actually, out of our summit, we're really proud. I think one of the initiatives we started very early in around women, and then 2 years ago started around innovators of color, was that we felt like, we felt like we needed to call out kind of the role of women. And so we hold an opening, facetiously called the Ladies' Lunch. We're going to try to make it more than an episodic, you know, piece, but we have 200 women. What we found in our, we invite 350 companies to present, their CEOs or founder presented to tech companies, learning and talent tech companies. And, last year we invited 350, that number's grown over time. And interestingly, since we've been polling those entrepreneurs, which is, you know, I think 3 or 4 years at this point, the number is consistently held that a third of those companies are founded or run by women today. And that's actually astonishing compared to typical tech companies. So a typical, you know, Silicon Valley or U.S. tech company, about 6% of those companies are run or founded by women, and about 6% of VCs are women. So I think that for whatever reason, it's crazy, right? I mean, yeah. So for whatever reason, we're seeing women, and maybe perhaps it's because they were professionals. I mean, because we certainly see a lot of teachers, but we're also seeing, you know, people coming out of Google and Yahoo, and, you know, people who have other experiences, who have had success in those careers and wanting to come into education to make a difference, and to have a successful business. So for whatever reason, we're very proud of having elevated these, you know, the fact that these women have, you know, we've got this really, it's not representational, so it's not 50-50, but it's a, you know, a heck of a lot better than other tech sectors. So that's actually really great. And I do think that you need to focus on it. So I think you need to just keep hammering on these statistics. I mean, we've actually tried to get people in the media interested in the disproportion, and, like, you know, it's not a story. I think it would be a story if we had no women. It's kind of hysterical, right? When you're actually having success, they actually don't want to talk about it. But I do think it's important. There's a group in, and the same thing for innovators of color. We had a big increase this year in, and I'll give the wrong numbers off the top of my head, but from single digits to low 20%-ish in innovators of color who had roles in the founding teams. And that was a huge move, and again, would be dramatically different than anything. I mean, it's certainly single digits in general tech.
Yeah.
We do think putting spotlight, you know, transparency is a really helpful thing, and it both inspires people to get involved as well as sort of makes people cognizant of the disparities. And there are organizations in the U.S. There's a group that the Gates Foundation has funded called Surge in Chicago. It is interesting. It's a boot camp for educational leaders of color. So they focus, it's run by a woman, Carmita Patrice, but she's African American, and she's focused on the of color side as opposed to women. But it's really awesome. She's out, like, she's bringing in boot camps, you know, groups. So she's bringing cohorts of leaders and basically putting them through a process that gives them the conviction and the self-confidence and the connections and I think we need to do a lot of that.
And did you have to go through that process, or did you always kick ass? Because you come across as someone who just definitely kicks ass.
You're very sweet. I was like, my children might say that. I'm like, in a negative way, I'm not sure. But I think I was really, it was really lucky when I woke up, however many, you know, probably 10 years, 15 years ago, and I was actually doing professionally the same thing. You know, I'd sort of honed in, you know, I'd been an investment banker forever, but it'd been broad stuff. And I'd really honed in on this education and talent technology vertical. And I woke up and I was doing the same thing philanthropically as I was. I mean, I was trying to, you know, in my philanthropic world as well as in my whatever, my give back world that I was doing in my professional world. And when I woke up and those two things came together, it was just a completely different ball game, because it was just, it was just like, you know, not everybody, I mean, you know, you're really boring because you have nothing to talk about except like one thing. So it's like,
it suddenly made sense and everything.
Well, just everything kind of like, when people are like, oh, you have so much, I'm like, not really. I mean, everything pretty much, you know, is synergistic with each other. So, you know, if I'm on the board of something, it's a Woodrow Wilson Foundation, which focuses on teaching excellence in the STEM fields. And so, while it's a board, but it's a philanthropic board, but it definitely gives me perspective on kind of what, you know, what's happening at the classroom level around issues of teaching STEM, which is a huge factor in the U.S. Everywhere, actually. It's been really fun. And the entrepreneur stuff, and I started angel investing just completely by chance. And there was no rhyme or reason. There was no methodical plan to do it. We just started seeing all these amazing entrepreneurs, a lot of women, and and companies that were like, oh, wow, I mean, this is totally different than what we've been seeing in the sector forever. And I was lucky in that I think that we and my partner Michael and my other partners in Chicago and elsewhere, I mean, I think we've been able to be really helpful to these companies because of all the other stuff that we do. So that's made the investing process fun because we're not just money. We're actually people trying to, really help move the ball forward for a company. And, and so far, so good. I mean,
And the age-old questions that everyone will want to ask. So do you have any advice for people in terms of angel investing and what you see resonate in EdTech? And then second to that, do you have any advice for teacherpreneurs, thinking of launching? How do they go about negotiating the investment field if they're trying to get something off the ground?
Well, on the teacher side, I mean, the thing that, and I'm not an engineer, I have two kids who are, teacherpreneur needs to make sure they've got a really, really good technology partner. So I think that the best, combinations of folks of where you've got someone with one unique talent, and that may be a perspective on a real acute problem in a teaching, and then you've got that person paired up with really great tech talent. I mean, for example, the Clever was started by two guys who went to Harvard, were both CS. I think they were both CS majors. I know Tyler was the CEO, but Dan was a Teach for America alum. So he was a Teach for America teacher in Denver, was sort of elevated to be the chief. When they realized how talented he was as a tech person, they elevated him to sort of help run tech in the school. At which point he realized there was no integration of data between all these digital products everybody was using. And so it was just all floating out there in this, inaccessible mass. And so they were, and they came together to start this company together, really by taking a teacher's perspective and a pure technology perspective and really built a very powerful product. So I would just make sure you partner with the right people. And if you partner with the right people, the venture stuff, becomes easy. I mean, it's all about, we call it the four P's: people, product, potential, and predictability. You need to think about all those buckets. And if you've got a great product that can compellingly scale, that becomes obvious. On the angel side, aside from me being an angel, people always ask me, well, who else? I don't actually band together with a bunch of other angels. I'm in companies together with other people, probably more often institutions or funds than I am with other individuals. But there were, there are, certainly in the U.S., there is a really robust angel community. Everything from, Mitch and Frida Kapoor, who we gave the Lifetime Achievement Award to this year at the summit, for all their amazing work around equity and access. They're very active angels. They're very selective. They have a very clear criteria in terms of impact that they want to have. But we have, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of individual angels. And what I tell people is you just have to kind of look at, pull. You have to look at companies and kind of pull up their financing data and kind of follow the trail of who invested. But angel investing is hard, right? Because it's in some perverse ways, it's ridiculous that one person would have 47 investments basically tying up your net worth in a single sector in private illiquid companies is probably the dumbest thing you've ever heard of. On the other hand, if it's not the dumbest thing you've ever heard of, it's the expertise you have it should give you a better instinct and a better window and a better ability to diligence, because it is, angel investment is very risky. And, I recently invested in a drone company, if you can believe that, obviously not in the education area, but I basically did it it was a Harvard Business School competition, and I was really impressed with the team, and I was fairly fascinated by what's happening around, artificial intelligence and drone technology, and I basically made sure to follow a very talented investor in that sector. So I think that's the kind of thing angels need to be looking for, is don't go out on your own, follow somebody make sure somebody's in there who really knows what they're doing in the sector. And then you have to really feel compelled about the people. It all comes down to the people.
And do you ever get that fear factor when large sums of money are involved, or are you just so, that's become the norm now?
Well, our angel investing is by definition not $5 million or even $1 million. So we've been really fortunate in that I've probably done about 51 including exits, and really only two companies have gone out of business, and actually one of them gave us some money back, and maybe three, but it's not much. So that's fortunate.
Given how many usually,
usually you would typically with the J curve, which is the concept that, you know, you have a huge number fail in the beginning and then it evens out. So far we haven't seen that. So I haven't had to kind of get there yet. You certainly had gulps, and we've had, it's the nature of the beast. So if you're going to have the gulps, then you definitely shouldn't be doing it.
Good advice. Two very final questions. One is, do you have anything you can give us on who might speak next year at JSV?
We've only confirmed one, and we can't announce it yet.
Exciting.
He's kind of fun. Yeah, it's kind of a fun one. Because what we try to do is we try to be a little unpredictable. So it's whether it's having Common, the Grammy and Academy Award winning rap artist who did an amazing session with four students this year, which was just terrific. And Common, actually, we had Common the year before.
Oh, cool.
We were actually hoping Common was going to be Common is a Hamilton the musical. He's very good friends with Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote it, and he's done a remix of one of the songs. We were actually at the time originally hoping he could do the song, but it's not been published yet, so he couldn't do it. But he did a fantastic interview, and is a very, very passionate man around the issues of equity and access, and children, pursuing their dreams. So we try to do a mix of the, Bill Gates, who obviously is. Although I will, the fascinating thing for me, because all my friends, became aware of the Bill Gates thing, because I got to interview Bill Gates, which was like a highlight of my life. But I was fascinated by how many people had no idea he did education. Because in the world that we live in, it's like, there's nobody who doesn't know that. But I was amazed by the number of people who sort of said, geez, I had no idea they were investing in education. So that was kind of interesting. But
they probably don't know that Zuckerberg is...
I guess not. Although he's maybe a little more visible. He's now so visible on it. Yeah. But we'll see. We'll see. So I think that what we try to do is make it a mix of people you'd expect and people you wouldn't expect. So we're hard at work trying to figure out what that's going to look like.
Well, excited to see.
We'll start announcing them, probably in the fall.
Okay, excellent. And then what does your afternoon hold here in London?
I think because the United States is now, I'm now on their clock. Unfortunately, after about 2 o'clock, I get pretty subsumed with being on calls in Chicago. So I think that's where I'm going to be.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And I hope you managed to fit in a cup of tea whilst you're here this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoy the EdTech podcast, please go absolutely gangbusters and share it with one friend who you think might also enjoy it. If you're a UK startup listening and interested in internationalising your business, don't forget to register for the free UKTI webinar I'm speaking on at 10 a.m. on the 10th of August. You can find the link on my Twitter page. See you next week when we'll be speaking to Richard Collata, Chief Innovation Officer for the State of Rhode Island and former lead in the Office of EdTech for the US government.